Hello, diners and travelers, snowboarders, skiers, skaters.
Something different.
Snow bunnies. Snowmen and women. That's plenty of what we have.
We do, don't we?
Yes.
More of it coming down as we speak.
Now you're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Hay.
Unfortunately, we're sitting in Pittsburgh, which does not have quite as much snow as if we were in New York or Charlotte or Atlanta or anywhere like that. So we hope you're managing to get through the winter wherever you are.
And we missed out on being on the dot on time for Happy Valentine's Day because we're on the...
Yeah, we did.
We didn't. Can say it now.
It's the closest you're going to get, right?
Right.
So here we are. So we hope that you and the one you love have suitable arrangements made for wining and dining and whatever else you feel like doing on this special day for lovers. What we're going to have, and I actually put a note up on the website a couple of days ago, that we're having bivalves and bubbles. And for those of you who don't quite figure that out, that's oysters and
champagne.
Well, it's not in this house, it's going to be champagne, well, method, sparkling wine, grown and vintned in California.
Okay.
And we have, I can't remember which of the cuvées out of the five we got from Gloria Ferrer I'm going to open. That actually did open. I've forgotten already which one it was.
Uh-huh.
I think it might have been the Blanc de Blanc, which is the one that the winemaker liked the best. And it was the one that was the last one we got.
And our special bivalves are, as always, from Taylor Fish.
Taylor Shellfish.
Yep.
We already ate them, remember?
Right.
You've forgotten already. John. here's a shout out to John Rowley. And the nice lady from Taylor's Shellfish who made sure that we got our shipment on time, arrived on the afternoon of the 13th, and the champagne, of course, was already waiting for it.
So we're all set.
So the oysters were all perky up and ready to go, and we managed to open them all, and we managed to eat them all. I don't know how we managed that, but we seem to be able to do that.
Yeah, I think so. That's
the last time we sat down with John Rowley.
How many dozens did we have?
We had four or five dozen, I forget which.
Yes, just the three of us.
Just the three of us sitting there testing wines to go with them as well. And it was fun, John. We thank you for that. And, of course, we thank you for your generous Valentine's Day gift as well. And we're thinking that perhaps you probably took the time to do the same thing yourself. Wouldn't surprise us anyway. Back to this silly snow. I mean, isn't it just hideous wherever you are? About the only thing that it does is that it brings to mind wonderful traditional dishes like chicken soup, which we've been eating for the last several days. And what did I make? I made a goat stew. This week, which is also very well appreciated and just the perfect thing for a cold winter's day. And we're able to survive because two important establishments are within walking distance of where we record on the menu. Whole Foods is about 600 yards away, and the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board's local store is on the way. So it's easy for us to practically hibernate. We don't need to drive anywhere. We hope that if you're driving, you're going to take care. And now, Anne says, why aren't we getting on with the program? And the answer is, I guess, because we had some thoughts to share, first of all.
Okay.
But we're going to start off with a leading authority, I think it's fair to say, on the subject of food and wine, the founder of what's the website called?
It's the Daily Meal.
The Daily Meal.
And Coleman Andrews has been on our show before, but he's taken to on the Daily Meal to do these. Who calls them listicles? Well, I love listicles. And this one I really wanted to talk to him about because some of the choices are curious. They're the 50 most powerful people in food, and I think you'll find this a very interesting discussion. We've talked many times with Coleman Andrews. Usually you have a different hat on each time we talk to you, Coleman. Right now we're talking to you as the editorial director of thedailymeal.com. Welcome back on the menu.
Nice to be back.
Yeah, and I guess the momentum for this discussion comes from the interesting list you did of America's 50 most powerful people in food, which I think is a task that is daunting unto itself. And I guess we want to ask, how did you proceed with that? How did you get 50 of the most powerful people in food.
Well, this is a list that we've done, fourth year that we've done it, and we sort of built on it, obviously. And we started out by really just all of the editors sitting in a room and throwing names around and just saying, well, who, and I mean, the way that we defined power was, who are the people that really, this isn't necessarily the people that we like or we think are the most admirable, although some cases they are, but who are the people that really affect what we eat, how we think about food, the people that really have the ability to change the rules, to rewrite the rules, to affect the conversation that we have about food.
So you say, and Thomas Vilsack, the Secretary of the USDA, is the right. most powerful person.
Well, I mean, he has been on the list, near the top in all of our lists, and I think he was given the number one slot this year because he really has a lot to do with the Farm Bill, which was, as you know, just passed. Didn't make, probably nobody was happy with it on
yeah,
either side of the aisle. Everybody thought it gave too much to the other side and too many compromises here and too many compromises there. But the everything from the, you know, the USDA a couple of years ago unveiled new nutritional guidelines, the MyPlate guidelines, which will have been to some extent and will continue to be very influential, I think, redrawing the famous food pyramid, and which in turn affect the way institutions in America plan menus and the way nutritionists are taught. He has a program recently, a couple years ago, this Rural Development Mission to create jobs around the agricultural sector. His influence on the Farm Bill, I think, probably did some good, probably not as much good as we would have wished, but ultimately he is in government, certainly, the figure that most affects food policy.
And I guess, Coleman, it's not just that he is the head of the U.S. Department of Agriculture for the time being. He's actually chosen to do something, if you like, interventionally, to use his power for what he considers to be good. Whether everybody else does, that's a different matter. But certainly, he thinks he's doing the right thing. And I think if you look at a world scale, he would have to be in the top three or four around the whole world just because of the amount of the world's food product that comes through the agency that he controls.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
So compared to him, I guess Thomas Keller is a pimple on the USDA, which is
right.
why he's a little further down the list.
Right, but he and Thomas Keller is on the list really as kind of an, I mean, he, as you say, he's quite a bit further down, but he's on there as kind of he's such an inspiration, whether or not he's an influence, because his food is so refined and so specialized, I don't think he's as much of an influence on the vast number of chefs and restaurateurs and even mass feeders that, say, a Wolfgang Puck is, but he is a standard bearer of quality and kind of an inspiration on a, maybe not on the actual food level, but on the more the philosophical level or the moral level almost to strive.
I have to believe that your positioning of Jose Andrus, you must have found that a rather entertaining thought. And just to explain to our listeners who are not exactly familiar with Jose and know him only as a restaurateur, he's also an importer of luxury foods from Spain. Better yet than that, he's figured out a way to persuade Whole Foods to sell a bag of his potato chips for $5. He's up to something interesting here.
Well, he is, but as you know, he's also very active in Feeding the Hungry in Washington, D.C., Central Kitchen. He has a wonderful project in Haiti after the earthquake there, really both celebrating the dishes of Haiti and making people aware that there are food traditions there, but also bringing ecologically supportable cook stoves to people there. And really, you know, he's really very much involved in a lot of admirable causes, in addition to being a completely crazy character, you know, very entertaining character. I was just in Madrid, Fusion, the big show there every January. And, you know, he was there, and I was with him for, at one point, trying to get from one end of a room to the other. And it took about 45 minutes because, of course, every single person, he either knows them or they want to know him, so they stop him and introduce themselves. Right. And it's like, pretty amazing.
Funny story about him, Coleman. We were at this Mistura event in Lima, Peru, together with the unveiling of the Latin American 50 Best Restaurants. And there was a big culinary symposium along there, but I had an interview to do with on the left hand side was Albert Adria, Ferran's slightly less famous brother, and on the right hand side, Andon Eduritz from Mugaritz.
And
the person who was supposed to be helping with the interpreting was unavailable, so I roped in Jose to do the interpreting.
Oh, lucky you.
Which meant, of course, the whole interview turned out to be about Jose.
Well, no, he was actually very good. He was a little resentful that he wasn't able to talk about himself.
Solely, you mean.
Oh, yeah.
But I let him do that just a little bit, just to humor him.
Yeah, of course.
But he is quite a character. Now, let's back up just a second.
Yes.
Now, this list deliberately is 50 most powerful in the United States, correct?
Yeah, America.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Is the guy from Pepsi that important?
It's a woman, actually.
Oh, Indra, right.
So that, perhaps that's why she's so important.
No, I don't think so. I mean, the PepsiCo, which goes far beyond Pepsi-Cola, you know, the company owns Frito-Lay, Quaker Oats, the Tropicana juices, Aquafina water, Gatorade. It is the world's, I think it's the world's largest group of food and beverage brands, and they generate more than $1 billion in annual sales, and it's just, you know, when we talk about power, that's a perfect example. When they decide, for instance, to introduce a new component in some of their products, when they decide to drop one kind of artificial sweetener and introduce another one, like stevia, this newly popular, not artificial, but natural, non-sugar sweetener, that has a tremendous, tremendous influence on the market. It just changes in a huge way. It's bad news for the people that produce the other sweeteners. It's good news for the people who are processing this natural sweetener. Or if they make a decision, as Frito-Lay did, I don't think not all of the Pepsi-owned products yet, but Frito-Lay several years ago said they would no longer use genetically modified corn in any of their products. That's a tremendously influential move economically and socially.
We agree completely. I mean, I think it's very interesting positioning. She's like number 7 or number 8.
She's number 5 on her list.
Number
5. Yeah, but I mean, it gives you it's an interesting insight into corporate America and corporate America's influence on food in this country, that she's in that position.
Well, you know, the interject in all, I mean, these are all people with profound, vast influences. To suddenly interject in the upper portion of your list, Pete Wells, and the other one was that got me was, what's your name? Susan Ungaro from the James Beard. I don't think that they have that breadth of influence, even close to it, that you would have with these big corporate giants.
Well, Susan Ungaro, as some of your listeners may not know, is the president of the James Beard Foundation.
Right.
She's not too high on the list. She's number 36. But Pete Wells is number 14. The justification for putting him there, and, you know, it's worthwhile pointing out with him and really with most of the people on the list, it's not really about the person, him or herself, as it is about the position. So it's not Indira from PepsiCo, Indra rather, Nuya from PepsiCo. It's whoever the chairman and CEO of PepsiCo happens to be. Mm-hmm. If that changes, then, you know, we forget Indra and we, you know, it's whoever that is. Pete Wells happens to be
the
restaurant critic of the New York Times. You know, if it was Bill Smith was the restaurant critic of the New York Times, that's who we would have on the list. The reason the restaurant critic of the New York Times is very important. Perhaps he's too high on the list, but he certainly belongs on the list.
No, he is important, but I just think if we're talking about the whole country.
Well, But he affects the whole country in this way, in the sense that he is arguably the one critic in the country that really can make or break restaurants.
Yeah.
And because he's doing it in New York, which is arguably the most important restaurant town. I'm not saying it's, I won't get into the argument of whether it's the best restaurant town, but it's the most important in the sense that it's the one that everybody watches. It's the one, even outside the food business, it's the one that investors watch. It's the one that businessmen, that real estate people who want restaurants going into their buildings, whether their buildings are in Philadelphia or Boise or San Diego, they want a star restaurateur to come in to anchor their new office building. They probably look to New York for a big star. And so what he does influences the restaurants of New York, and that in turn has influence on restaurants around the country.
Yeah, Tom Colicchio was a bit of a surprise.
Well, people watch that.
Well, the interesting thing is he was on Real Time with Bill Maher. He wasn't very interesting, by the way.
Well,
I hope he's not listening.
We've interviewed him.
he's on there not as a chef, although I think if you've, I'm sure you have been following his career, although he doesn't have much time in the kitchen anymore, but you know, he's a very talented chef, or he was when he cooked a lot. But he is, for many, many people, because he's on this incredibly popular television show, he is really a food figure that more than, if we leave aside the people who aren't really chefs, the Rachel Rays and so forth, or Martha Stewart, who have some food connection, but as a chef, Skank Puck is better known, but is not a regular, doesn't have a regular TV show where he's a personality like this. Colicchio is really has brought kind of a chef restaurant sensibility into everybody's living rooms, and that alone.
He did shock me with the advertising campaign that he drinks Diet Coke with food.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's amazing what people will drink with food if you make it worth their while.
Now here's another one that surprised me was the guy from Pinterest. Twitter on here?
We went back and forth a lot about all the different social media,
right.
And this is something that we track here about our own followers on Facebook and Twitter and Pinterest and Instagram and so forth. And Pinterest is really one of the most, in fact, I think it's the most important for us. It is just blown up.
Yeah, I don't understand it. I just don't understand it. But I know you're right, I think.
To answer your question, Twitter is not on here. Facebook is not on here. I could make a case for either, I guess, but Pinterest really is a means, as is Instagram, by which it's a major, major source of communication among people about many things, but about the food they eat, whether it's the food they cook or the food they have in restaurants today.
I thought that some of the ones you chose, like Whole Food Market and Weight Watchers.
Uh-huh.
And the scary one on here for me was Walmart.
Well, that's...
Well, as you know, that Walmart is the largest supermarket chain in the world, among everything else.
I understand it, but it's pretty frightening, isn't it?
Well, it is, and I mean, Monsanto is frightening.
Yeah, the Monsanto one I expected, though.
And as, you know, Archer Daniels Midland and Carco, but those again, or the Teamsters, which, you know, if it weren't for the Teamsters, food wouldn't get moved around the
exactly.
country. And also, Teamsters members actually are involved in a lot of food processing, too, not just trucking.
Which Jimmy Hoffa did you have, the one who's on the Giant Stadium or the current one?
This is Jimmy Jr.
Jimmy Jr., there you go. Okay.
Yeah, but you know, a lot of people don't realize that the Teamsters, you think of them, a lot of people think of them as basically being truck drivers, but they work in the bakery industry and the soft drink industry and the dairy industry.
Right.
And, you know, they're very, very important.
I'll ask you a question. I mean, here's this list, and it's sort of a communal decision with your panel or board or committee or whatever it is.
Right.
Is there somebody on here that you're surprised that made it? And is there one that makes you uncomfortable having them on that list?
There was certainly a lot of agreement and discussion about whether people belonged on here to some extent, but especially about their position on here.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think some of the people toward the bottom of the list, and again, I want to stress this has nothing to do with what we think of them or, you know, how much we like them, but, ultimately, you know, how important in the scheme of things is the CEO of a company that provides home delivery of meals, Matt Maloney, the CEO of Grubhub and Seamless. Our perception was this seems to be an area that's growing tremendously. And so maybe he is starting to really influence the conversation. Danielle Nirenberg and Ellen Gustafson from the Food Tank, we like them a lot. They're probably not super influential yet. We sort of think they will be more and more.
I mean, I agree that they are not yet that influential. It pretty much started out. I remember when they started sending a different email.
But you've got some thoughtful ones, too, like Bill Shaw, who's isn't he a Pittsburgher?
Yeah. He is actually a Pittsburgher.
And for Share Our Strength, is a reflection of the fact that you were very thoughtful in who you included in on the list. So I found a lot of the choices really rather fascinating. I'm sure there must have been much argument and discussion.
There was.
We've had much argument and discussion with you today. I can't wait to have another argument or discussion or however you might like to do it next year.
Oh, lovely. All right. I look forward to it.
So be sure to come back then. And in the meantime, of course, it's a delight, Coleman, as always, to talk to you here today on the menu.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Coleman. Bye-bye.
And we're not giving any clues about where we're going next, but it will be an interesting place, so do stay with us, and we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And you know, we're going to be talking about a place that's in the other part of the world, the other hemisphere. So it's going to be, it's not snowing there.
Well, you never can tell, but we don't think so.
Anyhow, Leticia is going to be talking to us about my Rio de Janeiro.
Oh, that's very clever. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is, as you probably know, if you're thinking Olympic thoughts, I guess the World Cup soccer World Championships are going to be in Brazil, near Rio, later this year, assuming all the stadiums stop falling down. And then in 2016, they have the Summer Olympics coming. So Rio de Janeiro is a great place to set your sights on. And here's a wonderful introduction to the food of a real native chef from Rio.
Leticia Morenas-Schwartz, you're advising me that I should go to Rio de Janeiro, and I'm ready. You grew up there and spent actually a large part of your life there, right?
Yes, that is correct. I was born and raised in Rio de Janeiro.
And now you published the first book called My Brazilian Kitchen?
The Brazilian Kitchen,
The Brazilian Kitchen, right.
Yeah.
And this new book is, and that was very well received, and this new book, My Rio de Janeiro, is coming out at an auspicious time for Rio, which is soaring in the charts for travel interest because of two upcoming events, the World Cup and also the next Olympics. That's pretty a lot to bite off and handle, isn't it?
That is true. Rio, all the spotlights are in Rio right now, and you bet that there's a lot of good things happening and some bad things too, but we'll focus on the good things, like the cooking of Rio, right?
Right. Now, you can characterize the style of food by the waves of influences in the country, and they're basically Portuguese, African, and what else?
Native Indian.
Native Indian. And there's no Spanish in there?
Well, I would say that Brazil in general is really a melting pot, and those three are the foundation of the culture that we have. Most of the Spanish, it comes through bordering, but we don't have, it's not like the rest of Latin America that we have a strong Spanish influence. Uh-huh. What we do have is a lot of German influence, a lot of Italian influence that later in the formation of Brazil, or let's say in the early 1900s, we saw a really big influx of other types of immigrations, like the ones that I just mentioned from Germany and Italy. But generally speaking, Brazil is a melting pot, so you might see some Spanish culture there, but the foundation is really Portuguese, Native Indian, and African.
Right. And now, you were a little unusual in your organization of your book. You organized this according to the neighborhoods of Rio, and apparently each neighborhood has its own characteristic that's pretty well established, and so that the eating establishments and the cooking styles at home are also very, very particular to that particular neighborhood. Is that what you did, and could you give us some examples?
Yeah, definitely. The structure of the book, we wanted to really invite the reader to understand the culinary dynamics of the city. And so we thought that, and when I mean we, it's me and the creative team and, in the publishing, my publisher is Kyle, and they're wonderful. They put in such amazing editors and graphic designers and the creative team behind. So when I refer to we, but what, going back to the structure, we decided to structure the book in a way that the reader really could take this book and travel to Rio with this book almost as a tour guide or a food guide. So we thought that dividing the book into neighborhoods would be a good way to do that. And you definitely see the different types of foods that you can eat in one versus another. But on the other hand, the difficulty that I had when we decided to structure the book this way is you have classics that are found in Rio, and they're really found all over. So when I decided to structure by neighborhood, they're really my favorite. They refer to what I think that, what I would recommend. If you were going to Rio tomorrow and you would call me and ask, Leticia, where should I go? And then I would say, you really need to try the cod feeders from this place. And you really need to try the caipirinha from that place.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, you will find cod fritters all over town and caipirinhas all over town.
Right.
So there's a certain personal aspect into the recommendations of what place is best for what.
Now, are the neighborhoods that you talked about, are they aligned with ethnicity, or are they aligned with social class? What is it that makes one particular neighborhood different than the one right next door?
Right. That is actually a big question for Rio, because one of the things that makes Rio one of the most interesting cities in the world is that there isn't much of a division between social class in terms of geography. Carioca people live back to back, shoulder to shoulder. It's a mix between the rich and the poor. So, for example, you have, I'll give you an example of a neighborhood that I grew up in, which was Leblon. So in Leblon, you have a lovely neighborhood full of nice restaurants and street vendors and bakeries. And then less than 5 minutes, you have one of the largest favelas or shantytowns. I don't know, how do you call it in English?
Shantytowns would be good.
Right. So less than 5 minutes, still in Leblon, and starting in Leblon, you have this shantytown called Rocinha, which really connects into another neighborhood called San Conrado, and the largest one basically in Latin America. So this
really amazing, huh?
Yeah, and that's kind of
slum,
like,
is the word
Rio
we're looking
so
for.
So interesting, yeah.
Slum, yeah. We saw
slum,
those.
Yeah.
We saw those, like, again, next to the fancy areas in Lima. That right next to it would be, I mean, it was like metal huts. I mean, that was basically it, with starving, mangy dogs.
And that's also another aspect about living in Brazil, and especially living in Rio for myself, as I can tell. I was born and raised there. You really go to the beach. It's a very democratic place. You put your little towel there, and right next to you is a person that lives on the Rocinha. So it's there is something extremely humbling, and you really inject that into your personality, that living with the poor and the rich mix back to back. It really does something into you.
It's really important. It's one of the biggest issues in social organizing at this point with cities, how to handle the differences in economic status.
Yeah. Right. Well, for a while, it has been kind of like there was this very harsh division. But lately, what is happening in Rio is that the society in general is more and more incorporating the slums into our way of lifestyle, especially food-wise. So, for example, for a long time, when I was growing up in Rio, for example, I never set my foot on the Rocinha, on the favela. I was afraid of it. I was scared that somebody would rob me or something like that. And now what's happening is cariocas themselves, carioca is a person born in Rio, cariocas are going into the favelas to eat specialty food, because I heard that Bar do Davi, or, you know, another bar, it's amazing at that favela or the other favela. So it's really, there's a certain democratization, if I can use this word again, that's coming into play, and I think that's really favorable. But Rio is far from being a perfect city. We do know that. We do face a lot of difficulties when it comes to the inequality. So there's a lot of bad things that come with it.
Now, you have little stories or notes that go along with your recipes, and my imagination was grabbed by your roulade with orange caramel sauce. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yes, that recipe is so special. Like every recipe in the book, I mean, when you ask me, it's like every recipe is amazing, but that one is truly amazing. It comes from a Portuguese woman that immigrated to Rio when she was 16, and today she is probably one of the largest caterers in Brazil. And what's interesting about it is that when I approached her, she makes a little treat called barriguinha de freira, which this would translate into, how do you say freira? It's nun, right? The nun, the priest and the nun, right?
Uh-huh, right.
So if you translate, the name is nun's belly.
Yeah.
And she wouldn't share that recipe with me because that is how she makes a living. But she really wanted to participate in the book. So she and her partner, they invited me for a lunch. And we had one of the most memorable afternoons that I can recall. And she taught me how to make this orange roulade, which is just amazing. And she tells me the stories of how egg yolks used to be left over from the nuns back in the convents years and years ago. And I was just fascinated by everything. So when I brought the recipe into my American kitchen, it really came out very, very well, just like she made it to me in Brazil. And I was so happy that we didn't even bother about the nun's belly, the other treat, you know, that she wouldn't share the recipe, because I just fell in love with the orange roulade.
Yeah, as I recall, the Portuguese have a lot of sweets named after nuns' body parts. I have no idea why.
Right. And actually, she told me why. She told me they would use the egg white to a million different uses. One of them that I can remember was to iron clothing. The other one was to clarify foods and clarify wine.
Right.
So they were left with lots of egg yolks. And they had to find something to do with all those egg yolks. And they decided to do sweets.
Now, let's hit right to the center, the heart of Brazil, with its national dish, feijoada. Now, I mean, there must be 10 million versions of this. We used to do a very large open house on Christmas Day, and I once made a huge feijoada, and people just were rapturous about it. They just were, you know, people who had been to Brazil remembered and so forth. As I said, there must be a million variations on this. I don't know which you decided to take. I love that you say a feijoada includes everything your mother ever told you to trim from a piece of meat and
right.
move to the side of your plate.
Right, that is true.
I mean, there's settle on this particular recipe. And tell us about it.
Right. So you are absolutely right. I mean, there are a million versions of feijoada, and I remember actually when I was doing my first book, The Brazilian Kitchen, I even included a chicken feijoada because it's like there are so many creative. But the classic feijoada, you're right, it's the national dish of Brazil. And what I try to do with this recipe is to make it so easy and so appealing to the American home cook. I find that every time that I make a feijoada, people are really intrigued because there is a certain thing special about beans and grains and lentils that's very healthy and very appealing to the American audience. And yet, they're not very familiar with our national dish, feijoada. Mm-hmm. So I spoke with the chef from this hotel in Ipanema called, in Portuguese we say Cesar Park. In English, you would say Caesar Park, something like that. And he really told me, the tricks and how to make it easy. And that was the inspiration for the recipe that I included in this book. But like what you say, what I try to encourage the reader when he takes the book in his hands is that you really don't have to buy the specifics meat that I list here. The feijoada is really like a blank canvas for beans and meats together. It's a celebration of beans and meats, but you can play with pretty much any kind of meat that you would like to. And that's the beauty of feijoada. I want to see people just going to the supermarket and say, okay, this is what they have in the store today, so this is what we're going to do.
But what are the other principal ingredients? I mean, we've got beef, but what is it that makes it uniquely feijoada Brazilian?
So the thing about the special touch that Brazilians add is a lot of different parts from the pork and beef, especially parts that you wouldn't normally eat. For example, pig's ears, pig's feet, tail, beef tail or ox tail. So there are some chefs in Brazil or some home cooks in Brazil that they think that the ear of the pig is so important and so fundamental to the feijoada because it adds that touch, that flavor, that they will put it in the stew and then remove it before serving.
Yeah, well, I didn't have a pig's ear in my feijoada, but I do like pig's ear.
No, but what's the seasoning that's peculiarly Brazilian?
The seasoning?
Yes.
So the seasoning, there is one type of pepper that we have that's called pimenta malagueta. That is one pepper that's very classic all over Brazil. And that's something that we do add to our feijoada. Some people add more, some people add less. But that seasoning is also very typical of the northeast of Brazil, in Bahia, for example. A typical feijoada is more characteristic of the depth of flavor and the combination between the beans and the meat. It doesn't rely so much on a specific seasoning per se. So if you don't have that pimenta malagueta, you're still good to make your feijoada, you know?
Well, that's a relief.
Yeah.
Well, honestly, this is such an interesting book, and I think that everybody's going to perk up at the idea of finding out more about Brazilian cuisine. It's just coming into the forefront, as is Brazil and Rio, the world stage, I guess I mean to say. So remember, it's My Rio de Janeiro, a cookbook by Leticia Morenas Schwartz.
And thank you so much for joining us today on The Menu, Leticia. Have a great day.
Thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure.
And we'll be back with our final segment for today right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, now, next we're going to jump to Paris. And
that's quite a jump.
Yeah, and Trish Desen is... She's Irish, but she's lived in Paris for 25 years, and she knows all the ins and outs and the nooks and crannies in the food world, and she put it all into a book called The Paris Gourmet, which is your handbook to having a really delicious time in the City of Lights.
Funnily enough, you might call it a little black book, but it's not black. It's yellow. I'm not really quite sure why she chose that color, but it's packed with information, and she's packed with ideas about what to do in Paris, how to see it like the natives do, how to really enjoy yourself more than you ever had before when you've been there. So here's Trish. Trish Desen traveled around the world to find a place where she could be famous because they named a river after her.
So Trish Desen,
how did you manage to do that?
Oh, it was quite easy, really. I fell in love. I fell in love with the city, and I fell in love with a man, and that was his name. So in those days, especially coming from Northern Ireland, it was much more usual to take your husband's name, and I took it and kept it because I started writing books with it, and it was just a little awkward to go when we stood up. So it's not my original name, but I like it very much. It's my children's name.
It fits right in with the city that you've made home for how long now?
For about 25 years, I've lived in and around Paris.
And you've got 25 years of what you might call a little black book entries, except it's a slightly smaller than little yellow book.
Yes, it's a yellow and pink book. Yes,
but
years of eating.
But it's got almost everything you learned about how to dine and eat and shop for food in the City of Light.
Yes, I wanted to make sure that it was. That it was quite concise, all the little parts of the book that I've called rules. Of course, they're not rules. Rules are made to be broken, so they're just little points, little pointers that I wanted to put in there because a lot of people, when they come to Paris and when they think about coming to Paris, feel slightly intimidated. I didn't ever feel that because I was very young when I came here and just sort of, you know, threw myself into life here. But increasingly, people say to me that they feel it's a very chic, a very cold and a difficult city to really get to grips with. So I wanted to alleviate a little bit of those fears and just make it a little bit irreverent, the way I was speaking about the Parisians and about the food here, and really just cut through. I mean, there are a lot of books about etiquette, a lot of books about do's and don'ts in Paris. So
oh, yeah, I like that, Lloyd. You gave tips on what not to do as a tourist in Paris. I love that. Nobody's ever written that before.
Well, thank you. It sounds a little bossy, but we jump off the page a little bit.
Now, here's a question for you. It seems to me that somebody somewhere in the French government or somebody in a position of authority decided that tourism dollars were very important to Paris, and as a result, people were told that it would be better to be more polite, and it would especially be better to be more polite to Americans. Now, have you noticed that, or is it just...
Well, I heard about that as well, yes. Apparently, it's a conscious effort from the Paris Tourism Board to get polite and be kinder. But I say a little bit, I touch lightly on this in the book, about how waiters and barmen in restaurants and cafes in Paris, you know, serving a customer is really only a small part of their job, you know, along with everything else. And they have a much greater job security than in many other countries in the world. So feel the need to be quite... They're not earning a living from their tips, put it that way. And also there's a kind of automatic égalité, you know, equality between a client and somebody who's serving them in a cafe or a bar. That the deference that a lot of English tourists are used to, especially in quite high-end restaurants, doesn't always happen.
Now, it's interesting, something else we observed was that people were much more anxious to practice their English than they were to have you struggle in your school by French. Now, I'm sure your French is fluent by now, but mine only gets fluent after dinner and after we've been there about a week.
I think that's quite unkind of them, actually, and I have noticed that, because even now, obviously, I don't have very much accent in French, but when I break into the third sentence, it's obvious that I'm not French, and yes, they'll start speaking to me in English, and it gets a little frustrating, that's for sure.
Now, let's make sure that people understand what they'll get and what they won't get if they acquire, which they certainly should, the book called The Paris Gourmet, which you just published. So it's like, as I mentioned, it's sort of like your little black book, but it's really not secret places exactly, but places that you selected out of literally dozens of other places that fit into the same categories.
Yes, I wanted it to be a kind of reflection of eternal Paris, and I certainly did not shy away from the places which could be considered as clichés or dated or old-fashioned. I think that when people come to Paris, especially for the first time, they need a little bit of guidance and a little bit of selection about the places really they shouldn't miss. And there, I mean, there's so many different reasons why one would go to a restaurant, one would choose a certain restaurant. And in Paris, a lot of them are a lot of the places, it's to do with the ambiance, it's to do with the decor, it's to do with a kind of perceived or absorbed idea of Parisianness that everybody seems to have. I mean, I had it about New York before I left there, before I went to visit there. And so when you get there, you kind of want to find a little bit of that. So one of the chapters is given over to that. It's very much the eternal Paris, the place where you will find what you've kind of dreamed of before you got there. And then there's another chapter which is much more about the gastronomie, much more about what you're going to find in your plate. And those are my favorites, so they're perhaps restaurants which are slightly more up-to-date. And then, of course, all the cafes and the pâtisserie and the cake shops and the chocolate shops. I have an incredibly sweet tooth, and Paris is really always completely satisfies it. Oh, sorry, trailing off?
You faded away almost to nothing there.
Oh, dear, and I was talking about my favorite subject, which was cake and chocolate.
I can think of his book. What's his name?
David Leibovitz.
David Leibovitz. Yeah, the Paris, the Sweet Life. We have that.
Yes.
There's a lot of sweets in Paris.
He's a wonderful writer, wonderful painter.
Yes, he is very good.
Now, here were a couple of things I tested out.
Right,
and we're so much in agreement, it's almost scary. the first is Chez L'Ami Louis.
Ah, yes.
which has to be the most overpriced restaurant in the world. And the one with the rudest waitstaff?
Oh, completely.
Oh, well, who wrote the absolute...
Hay Hill.
Oh, I laughed so hard over that. I mean, that review was a classic review.
But then there's another one. You may not remember because it's such a long time ago. L'Ambroisie in the Place de Vosges. It's such a nice place. We really couldn't understand why we didn't feel more welcome.
Oh, they're dreadful in there, aren't they? I mean, they really do. They look you up and down. And I had a bit of not a confrontation, almost, because I was inviting the friend who was with me for dinner. And when we got the menus, of course, my menu had no prices on it, and his did.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, would you mind giving me a menu with prices as well? And they looked as if I'd asked them, you know, something absolutely shocking. And so they did, and they made a bit of a fuss about it. And then when our main courses came, they'd mixed them up, and they gave my friend mine, and I got my friend's. And when I mentioned this, and they turned it around, the maître d' made a point of coming over to the table and saying, perhaps we thought that your main course was slightly more masculine.
Oh, no.
Really? I hope that when people read about places like L'Ambroisie, when they read the Paris Gourmet, that will just deflate a little bit of that.
Well, I think it'll make people feel better and realize it's really not them.
No,
it's the other guys.
But L'Ambroisie, I mean, if you if one can afford it, obviously, as it is eye-wateringly expensive. But I really do think that it is one of perhaps the last 5 or 10 restaurants in Paris where you have a perfect example of pure French historical gastronomie. It's worth it, but one would wonder why you have to go through that when you're shelling out so much money that you have to for that type of behavior. But I think in balance, it's worth it.
I couldn't understand how people, the last time we were there, which is several years ago, I couldn't understand how people could possibly afford to have dinner at Guy Savoy when the tasting menu, without even any water included, never mind any wine, was like €350. Mm-hmm. But we did go to his, we went to Bouquiniste.
Bouquiniste, and yes, it's just been refurbed, yeah.
And Maître Albert, which were much more reasonably priced,
mm-hmm.
and probably much more enjoyable anyway.
Well, it was the first 3-star dinner I ever had, and it's truly memorable. The artichoke soup with truffles and the little truffle brioche, I will never, ever forget the aroma of that. I mean, we could smell it about 10 feet away before it actually arrived on the table. That was wonderful. Wonderful, wonderful cooking, Guy Savoy.
Now, let's suppose that somebody bought this book, which they certainly
mm-hmm.
should do if they're even thinking about going to Paris. How long should they then spend in Paris so that they make sure they get to all the good places you suggested?
Oh, well, they'd need a lifetime, really, to get through everything.
And they'd have to
I think,
and cook.
Well, that is a lovely way of doing it. So many of my friends do that. They rent a little apartment very often up in Montmartre for 3 or 4 days and then just wander around. And I don't know, perhaps the first trip to Paris for about a week, 5 or 6 days at least. I think 2 or 3 really is not doing it justice. And to work through everything in the book, I think you... It depends if you're walking between each address.
Well, do you have a place in here? We have friends who have an apartment, and is it near the Marais?
It's in the same quarter as the Marais, but it's in a different corner.
So we were there for the election when Obama won.
The first time, and
they wanted to have a brunch, and they wanted a Obama bagel event. And we had to go looking for bagels. This is not the easiest thing to find.
No,
and what did we end up paying for these bagels?
And they were very expensive, and they were not very good.
Well, American, I don't know, that in some cases that's fast food, but American street food is hugely popular in Paris at the moment. I don't have many addresses in the book because I don't tend to go to those places, but it's really taking over. The Brooklyn feel and the Brooklyn look in Paris is very, very hot right now.
Well, you won't want to go to those places if you want to find out what Paris is really like.
I don't think that
isn't where you'll go.
You cover a lot of ground here. How to stalk a Parisian pantry.
Yes.
I thought that was really very clever.
Now, the thing you won't find, and I think it's important to point this out, you won't find which tourist sites to go to.
I think
that's eminently sensible because
everybody knows.
There are plenty of other guidebooks. There aren't any more books like your yellow book.
Well, thank you. I wanted to make it different. I'm obviously, as is my publisher Flammarion, extremely aware that there are many places to go online to get the hard information. So I have a list of very good websites that are in the book. A lot of my fellow British or American writers who have websites where you will get the very, very latest hot restaurants, bars, etc., where you can go if you're into that sort of thing. So that's why I want it to be a little bit more different. Something I hope, I mean, I don't know how people will use it. I hope people would read it before they come, or perhaps people who may never come. You know, I was very much thinking of someone quite far out in the countryside in Paris who's not going to make it to Paris for a few years, or perhaps someone in the Midwest who's always dreamed of coming and hasn't quite made it yet. So it was to give a color and a feel of the place and to just make it feel more accessible. Rather than, as I say, hard facts, I think those are just at your fingertips online.
Well, before we go, I must mention one thing that I thought was particularly valuable, because it's always a challenge, is what to do on Sunday.
Oh, you know, I could write a whole
can you go
book
on Sunday?
About that, Peter.
Yes, you probably could.
I really would love to because, and I think, I mean, Sundays are being slightly challenged at the moment. There's been a lot of debate over the last week because a lot of the stores want to open on Sundays, but Sunday in Paris is extraordinary. I mean, as you know, after 1 o'clock, everything dies, and there are huge swathes of the time that you know, like something from The Walking Dead. You know, there's nothing there at all,
yeah,
and nothing open. So it's important, I think, to know which spots you can go to. And if you're going out for the afternoon, to team it with somewhere to visit and perhaps a walk or something to do, and then a cup of chocolate or somebody's wonderful eclair.
I have a feeling that this won't be the last of the books that you'll contribute to the Parisian Visitor, Trish. I'm sure you have a whole lot more secrets, whether you call it part deux or what you call it. I really don't know, but I can't wait for it to come out because we've been to Paris any number of times and we still feel like strangers.
Yeah.
And
oh.
and your book is going to be very helpful to make us act like we're not so much a stranger because we'll know much more about where to go. So
thank you so much. That was the aim of it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the menu.
Well,
and
thank you for inviting me.
And we'll give your love to your native land when we get there. Coming
Please
up very
do.
Soon.
Thanks, Trish.
Thank you very much, Sam.
And there you have it, another on-menu program in the books. We hope you'll enjoy it, and you'll join us again same time, same place for another episode of On the Menu Radio. And until then,
bye-bye.